welcome to episode 50 of Understanding Latin American Latin American Politics, a podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I am a political science professor at UNC Charlotte, and today I am talking again, and I say again because Adam Isaacson was my guest on episode 3, so wow. That was like a year and a half ago. And he's director of the Defense Oversight Program for the Washington Office in Latin America. He's been studying Colombia and its conflicts for many years. But with the timing of having him on is that he was just there for like a month evaluating a USAID project about bringing government services to post-conflict areas of the country. So, Adam, thanks again for doing this.
No, thank you, Greg. It's great to be back.
So last time we were, I went back to that episode, and it was just right before the vote on the, referendum, on the peace process or the peace agreement. And so at that point we were talking about a lot of speculation about what might happen. And so now we've had a year and a half to kind of see what happens. And since you were just there, I think this is a great way to get a firsthand account. Now, I know, and I was looking back at your blog posts also, and so I know you have a non-disclosure agreement, so I'm not going to really, I want to ask you about exactly what, you know, you were finding with USAID, which isn't the purpose of what I want to get anyway, but give me a sense of what kinds of places you went.
Well, sure. I don't usually do this sort of evaluating projects kind of thing, but this was something very close to what I've been working on in the past. I've been fascinated by this issue of how do you get a government into a place that simply never had a government, and by government, more than just a military and a police force. And we'd published a bunch of critiques of past efforts to do this, but they asked me to look at a program that they've been running since just before the peace accord was signed, about a year before, that is trying to use sort of rapid response techniques to get the government physically into Putumayo along the Ecuador border, Norte Santander along the Venezuela border, and Arauca also along the Venezuela border. Three areas that have a lot of presence of other armed groups, two of which have incredible amounts of coca being grown in them, and where for the most part there already are some pretty strong existing social organizations with whom the program has tried to work. So it was an opportunity to actually, you know, in this interesting moment for Colombia to spend a week in each part of the, all three of those, a week each in all three of those parts of the country, and talk to officials, talk to, you know, NGOs, campesino groups, women's and indigenous and Afro-Colombian groups, and also an additional week in Bogota talking to the people supposedly running these programs at the national level. And in general, just getting a sense of how well and how badly is the Colombian government implementing the peace accord that was signed back in November of 2016.
Okay. And I mean, it seems to me, I'm glad to hear that in the sense that WOLA is obviously often quite critical of U.S. policy, but then to be bringing you in at least suggests, hey, we're interested in trying to make these policies actually work.
Yeah, I mean, Colombia, between, say, 2006 and about really around, kind of petered out around 2013, Colombia had a program called the National Territorial Consolidation Program, which was sort of seen as Plan Colombia 2. They picked out about 40 or 50 municipalities around the country where they were going to try to do this sort of phased, staged effort to get the government into new areas. And, you know, we thought the model was interesting. It was designed by largely by the guy who went on to lead President Santos's peace effort, Sergio Jaramillo. On paper, it was very interesting. In practice, it often ended up with the military and the police being in areas and the rest of the government just not showing up. And why that was an interesting question. And so nowadays, now that there's a peace accord and you're not starting with the military and police, how are they going to do this? And I was pleased that they asked me to come, because we'd been pretty critical of how the consolidation program went. I was pleased that they asked me to come and help give an honest look at what's going on about a year and a half into this new program.
Now, just to start it with a general question, in thinking about implementation of the peace accord, after all your time there, did you come away with a sense of the glass being more empty or full?
I probably would trend toward the empty side. I'm worried about a lot of aspects of it. And I'm still sort of perplexed at how even a lot of easy things aren't being done. The good news is that everywhere we've been and everywhere else I've been in Colombia for other purposes for the last year has been much more tranquil for the most part. I mean, I say for the most part because tranquil, I mean, you can actually travel just about anywhere
Right.
without much concern about being kidnapped or something really horrible happening to you, including places that were completely off limits before. But at the same time, if you're a social leader, a victims leader, a member of the sort of the comunal movement, people who are sort of elected advisors for their towns, if you're signed up for a coca substitution program, you're facing threats, and you're the numbers of people from those categories who have been killed in the last 2 years have shot upward in a really alarming way. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights just put out its report over the late last week, early this week, and they focused heavily on this because it is alarming and indicates a lot less space available for participation in politics after the peace accord. However, if you are not a social leader, the peace or the level of tranquility has been palpable. That's the reason. That's the qualified good news. The worst news is that the first steps of implementing a peace accord, you can't give the Colombian government great grades on implementing. By first steps, I mean reintegrating ex-combatants. Disarming them went well, but then actually finding something for them to do and making sure they don't melt away into the countryside and rejoin crime or armed groups, that hasn't gone as well. Substituting coca, which is never going to be easy, has also stumbled mainly, it seems, for a lack of sufficient funds, which leaves me scratching my head because I thought that they were going to sort of have a Marshall Plan in place to help implement all of this. Transitional justice will get started sometime later this year in earnest. How to try people for war crimes and both guerrillas and military for war crimes. But it really had a rough time in its passage through Colombia's Congress as they made a law to make it happen. And there's a lot about that system that's going to need to be fixed before it really starts operating. So, and that's the first stage, the sort of low-hanging fruit. I mean, paying maximum $500 million to reintegrate ex-combatants shouldn't be that difficult. A $1 to $1.5 billion program over several years to substitute coca shouldn't be that difficult. Getting state presence, even a rudimentary state presence, into areas where there hasn't been one, now that nobody's shooting back at when you do it, that's harder, but it should be doable, and it's way behind schedule. And then, of course, there's larger commitments in the peace accords that will take years to do, where we're also just not seeing the initial progress. The Colombian government really committed itself to a very ambitious set of investments in the countryside to get the rural development model working for small farmers, which they haven't even introduced the law to make happen yet, much less pass the law. And there's a lot of concerns about how you're going to be able to really guarantee that opposition political parties, especially ex-guerrillas, will really be able to participate in politics.
Yeah,
It's a long list.
so is you mentioned laws. Is this a Santos thing or is this a Congress dragging its feet thing?
Most of the laws, I mean, a real blow, I mean, well, the first initial blow, I should say, was the plebiscite of October 2nd, 2016, when by a 50.2 to 49.8 margin, the Colombian people turned down the peace accord and forced them to go renegotiate bits of it. Despite what I predicted based on seeing the polls last time I talked to you, that the plebiscite did not pass.
Right.
And while they managed to recover the process, I think the political blow was enormous, and it became much harder for Santos to twist arms and or for people in Congress who are on the fence about this to really be enthusiastic about moving forward with implementing what was promised to the FARC, or what was prom not just what was promised to the FARC, but what was in the accords that actually would probably would help Colombia become a more modern country, but would require sacrifice. People were less willing to make that sacrifice. And then a further blow happened, I believe it was in May of 2017. For a while, the Congress had been passing the laws necessary to implement the peace accords under a sort of a fast-track process, meaning, you know, limited debate and get it through without a lot of, you know, amending things article by article. In May of 2017, the Constitutional Court took up a case brought by some of the supporters of President Uribe, former ex-President Uribe, who opposed these peace talks bitterly the whole time, and decided to dismantle much of the fast-track process. And after May, much, much less peace implementation legislation got passed. It didn't throw out what was there before, but it did slow the pace enormously, so that even just getting the transitional justice system up and running happened at the very, literally the 11th hour, just before the deadline of December 1st, 2017 expired. And a lot of legislation, including for implementing rural reform and political participation, just fell apart.
And thinking of the plebiscite, there's a big urban-rural split. And so obviously you were seeing some rural areas. What kind of mood did you find in rural areas versus, say, Bogota?
The rural areas that we visited that had been quite conflictive had almost all voted for the plebiscite, voted for the yes. You know, in Putumayo, the Catatumbo region of Norte Santander, most of Arauca were for the plebiscite, often by a wide margin. The larger towns in those areas went for the no in many cases, especially in Norte Santander. So it really was, you're right, a rural-urban split in these conflictive areas that we'd been to. The attitude on the ground, you know, a year and change later, was in some areas, well, across the board, I should say, again, that sense of greater tranquility was always there underlying everything. But in some areas, there was a sense of disappointment. I think people thought, particularly people in, say, mayor's offices or leaders of community organizations, thought that it was going to start raining pesos, that there was going to be a lot more resources and a lot more help with them just trying to solve the basic problems that they've been facing in a sort of a stateless area. And there's only been a trickle of assistance. The arrival of a few officials from these new agencies that have been created from the post-conflict, who themselves don't have a lot of resources. So some sense of having to really readjust expectations that may have been too high, but certainly have gone unmet. And then in other places where the ELN guerrillas, the National Liberation Army, the second largest guerrilla group with about 1,000 or 2,000 members, where the ELN is still active, just a sense that what had happened with the signing of the Havana Accord, what one person dismissively referred to as La Paz de Santos, was just not really relevant to their day-to-day life. That this was, you know, unless we fix what's going on with the ELN and organized crime and other groups, we feel somewhat safer without the FARC, but not that much safer. And there's still a long way to go.
Okay, so you have the ELN on one hand, then you have the threats on the other. Are these threats just dispersed? Are they organized in any way, or what was your sense of that?
You know, I went into this actually with more of the impression that the vast majority of these threats were the work of sort of a nexus of landholders and right-wing politicians and political machines and people who didn't want to give up any of the privileges they've always had. And there's certainly some of that nexus there, which, you know, creeps into state institutions as well in some of these areas. That's certainly one of the main causes. But I would reduce their after being there and talking to a lot of people, I would reduce their share of the problem. The ELN and other organized crime groups unconnected to traditional power structures are also they're competing for control of areas left behind by the FARC. And that competition for control can mean trying to, and often for criminal reasons, but that competition for control can mean, it means it trying to clear out any independent voices who could be an obstacle. And so it could be the ELN or ELN-tied groups, or the Urabeños, or other local organized crime groups. The Urabeños is the biggest network of sort of just plain old drug trafficking organized crime groups around the country, which resembles a gang in some places, resembles an army in others. And then there's smaller regional ones like that around the country too, making it a very confusing picture. Sometimes those groups could be in cahoots with big landowners or, you know, the local political boss who buys all the votes on election day. Or sometimes they may just be new guys who've come around, or they're operators, or somebody who split off from somebody else, and they're not that connected. But either way, they are, if you are A Junta de Acción Comunal leader, a community action board member, that's what that is. Or if you're, you signed onto an accord for coca substitution, or you're somebody trying to get land back, or just somebody who's just sort of been there for a long time and recognized as a leader, you may be getting threats and may be getting hounded out.
And of course, the part of the state resources were intended to bring the state in to make sure that no vacuum developed that was going to then be filled by such organized crime, right?
That was the idea.
And that money's not coming in, or not enough.
Not enough. The government has prioritized 170 municipalities or counties around the country, and there's 1,100 counties in Colombia, places that were hit hardest by the conflict. There's a plan. There's always a plan in Colombia. There's a plan to get a lot more services there, and they've had teams of people really since last summer visiting all of these counties, visiting just about every vereda or hamlet in these areas to talk to the population, get a diagnosis of what their needs are, and build relationships of some kind between the national government and these people for the first time. So people are seeing these faces of the government for the first time, but it's still too often just a few people parachuting in, either from Bogota or from the provincial capital, and not staying. They come, they get some information, they leave, and there's an idea that they'll sign a paper, and eventually that blueprint will serve for more services and more presence. But we're talking a long time frame here. And so for now, no, there's not a lot of additional protection for people under threat. I mean, Colombia has tried to reshuffle the way their early warning system works, and hopefully it will work because it will give. Hopefully, it will help because it will give more voice to the Human Rights Ombudsman's Office, more ability to actually order early warning protections for people. The Human Rights Ombudsman's Office, I think, right now is actually trying to do a solid job and deserve the support. But ultimately, it's up to the Defense Ministry whether it wants to move people out to who can actually protect somebody.
Right.
And it's up to the Attorney General's office to actually investigate the networks of people who are behind this. And both of them are dragging their feet.
And another actor are dissident FARC members. I was just seeing the news that the Colombian military now thinks there's like 1,200 members of the FARC who did not demobilize. How much concern, particularly in the countryside, is there about them?
A lot of them did demobilize, but have gone back. Mentioned at the beginning that there's been, the Colombian state has, they made a bunch of promises for reintegrated guerrillas, and there were 8,000 of them as late as last, June or July, who were concentrated in 27 zones around the country where they had been to, turn over their weapons to a UN mission. About 8,000 of them there, another, say, 2,000 to 3,000 former militia members, part-time guerrillas who lived in cities who had also gone there to register themselves, plus another 3,000 plus who had been let out of prison, many of whom were in those camps. According to the UN, they were all free to go according to the peace accord on August 15th. If your crime of rebelling against the state was amnestied, some of them, about 3,500, are going to have to stand trial for war crimes eventually, but everybody for now is free to go. And so a lot of them just started leaving these zones. By November, the UN said that there were 45% of the original population was still in the zones, and they didn't have a whole lot to do. The government had not gotten together a decent offer for the FARC in terms of vocational training, remedial education, psychosocial support, help with starting a business, help with getting land, which it turns out a lot of guerrillas just want to be farmers. That sort of boggles the mind. This is sort of a basic thing you expect. One of the main lessons learned of any peace transition is that you find something for ex-combatants to do, and it's been delayed horribly. Some of that is because the FARC themselves insisted on having a collective demobilization plan, so they can keep their cadres together as they become a political party. And they weren't all clear on how exactly that would look either. So the blame is not all the Colombian governments, but the result is here we are a year later, and a large number of these ex-guerrillas have nothing to do. A large number of them have gone off, and we don't know where they are now. They might be back with their families, but some of them may have reintegrated these new dissident groups, which are quite strong in the south-central part of the country, parts of the Pacific coast. Not so much the area that I visited, but the areas that I visited, but people are talking about it. It may be happening as there's more and more unoccupied guerrillas floating around. And yeah, the military just came up with that figure of 1,200. The Fundación Ideas por la Paz, a great think tank in Bogota, estimated last month about 1,000 to 1,500. And every day, I think it's growing. And it's growing because of, you know, unoccupied ex-guerrillas, but these groups are perfectly capable of recruiting new people too, which I think they're doing quite a bit. And they're, you know, they've taken up where the FARC left off, running a lot of the coca trade in Guaviare, Meta, the south central part of the country. I think they're linking up with, you know, Brazilian organized crime. Brazil is the number two cocaine market in the world. And you know, they're active, increasingly active in the Pacific as well, which is a big cocaine route. They're in illegal mining. They're extorting just the way the FARC used to, and apparently in parts of the country they're resolving disputes the way the FARC used to. One thing I heard a lot about what people missed about the FARC was that, you know, if your neighbor stole your cattle, or your wife ran off or your husband ran off and was cheating with someone else, or you know, you had some dispute to settle, you could go to the FARC, the Comandante, and they would do it very harshly, but they would probably resolve that dispute some way, in a very Solomonic way probably, but also very harsh, maybe involving killing somebody if they thought they deserved it, within a week or two. Whereas in the Colombian justice system, if you had a dispute like that, you probably have to wait about 2 years before you got some resolution.
Right. So we have presidential election coming up pretty soon. And
May 22nd, yeah.
Yes, and the last poll showed conservative Iván Duque suddenly have this jump in lead.
Yeah.
And so, you know, at least you can say there's a very good chance you're going to have a conservative president elected. How is that? Is that just going to put a stop to what's already been a trickle, or how do you think that's going to affect what's going on right now?
Yeah, I mean, on the ground, it'll be hard to say what's different, but let me explain. If Duque is elected, which is looking increasingly probable because the right is unified and the left is not, if Duque is elected, he can't stop the peace process. He can't ignore the accords legally. The Colombian Constitutional Court last October decided that the accords are the law of the land, and every administration has to respect them for the next 12 years. Now, okay, that's the law of the land. That's what's on the books. But of course, if Duque wants, he can slow walk it to death. However, as I said, it's not always clear what the difference will be, because the Santos government has not been moving with alacrity either to implement the accords, nor has it devoted a lot of resources to it. The incentive to slow walk it increases now that the FARC tried themselves, you know, had their first electoral test on March 11th in the congressional elections in Colombia. Where the left did better than it almost ever has, but the FARC did not. The FARC got a total of 0.3% of the vote, showing that there was no sort of silent rural majority supporting them. So they're weaker and have less ability to push for what they want. So yeah, if Duque wants, he can, without formally dismantling the accords, he can simply just probably get away with ignoring a lot of the commitments. As a lot of people are already charging the Santos government.
Just starve them of funds. I mean,
that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
Starve them of funds and don't implement the rural accord at all. Or if you do it in a very minimal way. So there's that. I mean, maybe the larger concern, is whether Duque will be committed to really protecting, FARC ex-combatants. And whether he and say could just come up with some pretext to extradite many of the 50 or 60 who are wanted by U.S. justice, for narco-trafficking or for kidnapping or for other crimes, and just send them to U.S. justice saying, oh, they did something to not comply. If he does that, I think it would be very hard for Colombia ever to negotiate credibly a peace deal with any future insurgent or paramilitary group, because it's pretty clear what will happen to you. But there will be a temptation, I think, to do that. And the right in Colombia has gotten so much mileage out of the FARC as, you know, a convenient boogeyman. The FARC are sort of, you know, like Trump with MS-13. You can always beat up on the FARC because the FARC were always obliging in being violent and committing crimes against the population and sort of fitting their own stereotype. And even in their weakened state, I bet they can still be a punching bag for a right-wing administration. And that will, you know, the message there will be that, you know, these future groups like the ELN who negotiate, this is what you have ahead of you, is continuing to be reviled, maybe extradited, and maybe even, you know, jailed, and continue to be blamed for all the country's problems, even in your weakened state.
Right. Okay, so I got just one more question, and I want to, it's shifting gears a bit, but this was from one of your earlier blog posts. Tell me about the border, the Venezuela-Colombia border, because you went to see it firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, we were in the border city of Cúcuta, which is a city of about 500,000 people on the Venezuelan border, which is sort of the main entry point, or the largest entry point for all of the Venezuelans who are fleeing into Colombia. And since we were there, you know, for this evaluation work, the Venezuelan issue wasn't a main issue, but we were like, hey, it's 5 o'clock on Tuesday. Let's just take a cab to the border bridge and see what it looks like. And, you know, we had seen a lot of Venezuelans, you know, begging at stoplights and in the park and, you know, massed outside the city registry to legalize their status and things like that. But going down to the bridge, it's about a 15-minute cab ride from downtown Cúcuta, was pretty shocking. I'd been there about a year and a half before when Maduro had closed the border and things were pretty calm there. But this time there were a couple of thousand people massed around. As soon as you get even anywhere near the bridge, there's one of the first things you see is about 50 guys just pushing like those dollies like the UPS guy brings.
Yeah.
You know, they're empty, but they're ready to be hired to take your luggage for a tip. And you get closer and you see this line into Colombian migration that's just snaking and serpenting all over the place as people are just waiting to register. And every minute, another couple dozen people cross the bridge. I would say maybe a quarter of them were, you know, with baggage. And there's taxis lined up with their trunks open to take people after they've gone through migration and handle their baggage. And there's just a whole bunch of other people just kind of sitting around looking exhausted with their bags. And, you know, just thousands of people and a few police, you know, Colombian police have put up barricades. They're trying to keep some semblance of order. There's, you know, the Colombian Migration Authority has put up like a lot of sort of awnings and tents to accommodate all of the demand. But I was just shocked by how much it looked like the most sensationalist news coverage of the exodus of Venezuelans and how, you know, given how, you know, how dis not just disorderly, but how sort of on edge everything looked, like it looked like, you know, a fistfight could break out any time and really, you know, there would be nothing the police could do to contain it. But just given how chaotic it looked, I was surprised, I guess, by sort of just how little attention this crisis is getting. That's changing, I guess, in the last week or two. The European Union and USAID have both started to authorize more aid to Colombia to help deal with this, because Colombia is really not able to put a lot of resources toward the Venezuelans at all, and it seems to be, you know, draining the public health system and other services in that part of Colombia, which already didn't have a lot of resources.
Yeah, because of course you're looking at the same places that are trying to deal with demobilization, implementation of the peace accord, whatever.
Yeah.
So all of these resources are scarce.
Yeah, all the places we went. I mean, in Norte Santander, this was already draining resources needed to implement the peace accords and also just to help the population in these areas. And you know, a lot of it, especially at the local level, was having to go to attend to Venezuelans. And then in Putumayo, the capital, Mocoa, back in March of last year, there was this horrible mudslide that killed about 500 people. Some people say as many as 1,000 people. And just the rebuilding effort there drained a lot of resources that could have gone to, you know, the post-conflict effort. So, you know, there's always something going on at a time when, you know, Colombia was hit pretty hard by the drop in oil prices, not as hard as Venezuela, but it sucked a good 20 or 30% out of the central government budget, and they haven't gotten that back. And yeah, I mean, that has made it much harder to implement a peace accord that was, you know, the most expensive parts of which were signed at a time when oil prices were riding high.
All right. Well, with that, we're out of time. I've been talking to Adam Isaacson, who's director of the Defense Oversight Program for the Washington Office on Latin America. Adam, thank you again.
No, thank you for having me, Greg.